So let's take some questions and answers. Now, you can't tell me that nobody has anything to say. Well, the Turks are, you know, very strong that they want to destroy the Kurds because there's 17 million Kurds in Turkey and there's another 15 to 20 million outside of there. A different government might change its mind. I think a Recep Erdogan is very unlikely. But I think someday they are still the biggest group of people in the world that doesn't have a state. They have 35 million people. There might be somebody else somewhere. But basically, they are. So I think at some point, the West may honor their offer. It was 1920, 1921, that the Kurds can have their own state. But as long as the Turks and the Iranians have the views they have about the Kurds, and why do they dislike them so much? What are they, Shiites or Sunnis? Sunnis, mostly Sunnis, mostly. But not just Sunnis, they are pro-Western and so forth. So I think it's going to be a time, it could be another couple dozens of years. Also, I think that the Kurds have to stop having this tremendous infighting that they have between, what is it, YPG. They have two elements. One is very kind of radical and supports terrorism, and another one is much more moderate and westernizing. I think if the latter one can win out eventually, but I don't think they're going to win out anytime soon because they're feeling, we did all this fighting for the Americans, for the West, to show that we're pro-Western reformers. And the West's response to that is totally not interested because we want to get along with the Turks, we want to get along with other countries. So I think it's still going to be a long time for them. But first, they've got to get their act together. Not that every state in the making doesn't have some of this problem, but just in their case, it's unusually strong. And otherwise, people would be admiring them for what they did on the field of battle. Although right now, the Turks are beating them, and they're withdrawing. I think that Syria. You know, I think for the Russians, for the Turks, enough is enough. But you also got to remember, they don't want a strong Syria. It's against their national interest. So I think that the way it is will probably, or close to the way it is, a third and a third and a third is probably the way it'll stay. But partly because nobody really cares what the Syrians think. Did you see for a final point, did you see how much it's going to cost to fix Syria? It has 22 million people, you know, between 4 and 8 million fled abroad. Overall, 50% of the population is displaced. Did you see how much it's going to cost just to get them back to a very poor level? $250 billion. Where's that going to come from? Who is going to pay?
What is going to be the effect of the United States moving their embassy to Jerusalem?
How should we say this? Not much is going to change. First of all, this is the old consulate. They're really moving into the Israeli consulate. It's going to take 4 or 5 years, maybe much more. I mean, I was born and grew up in Washington, D.C. I'd be shocked if they can do it in less than 10. I mean, things just move very slowly. Once, as far as the Israelis are concerned, okay, it's fine, we won. They're not going to push because they have much more important things to deal with. They're worried about Iran. They're worried about Iranian nuclear weapons. They want to decide what's the relationship with Turkey. It's very uncertain where they are. It's clear with Iran, but it's not clear with Turkey because, as I said, Israel and Turkey had a very good relationship. And now they still have some of that trade relationship going. I was reading that much of it's still going on at the same rate from before, which suggests that the Turks can't make up their minds what they want to do. Because if you're Turkish, they also have major problems. They have to worry about Iran, because Iran is definitely stronger than they are right now. And the people and the Shiites and so forth are strong, whereas the Sunnis are not that strong for Turkey after what they just did. So I think that given all of that, it has some significance, but I don't think it really matters. I mean, basically, the question is, Does this put off even further a final resolution of the Israel-Palestinian dispute? And the answer is, it's not clear. It may well, it may not. But what's powerful is, if you look at the Israeli offers, there are several of them, but in the last 10 to 20 years, they were willing to give 92, 94, 95% of the territory in the West Bank to the Palestinians. They got turned down on that. So I think the issue about where the American embassy is going to be is somewhat overplayed. It's not going to make much difference to people one way or the other. For most of them, they're just going to continue to go to the, you know, what they viewed, you know, as representing Jerusalem, but now it represents something national. And who knows? We get another president in, might decide not to do it, especially with the temptation to say, I want to save billions of dollars. Yes, now, the people who know everything. That shows you know everything. The people who tell you they know nothing, they're the ones to always be careful of. Well, not all of them. I think among the younger generation, for example, in Iran and in much of Turkey, judging by the hundreds of thousands that came out each time in Turkey against Tayyip Erdogan and his 51%, I think among the younger people, we were just discussing even in Israel, that some among Jews, there's different elements, and this may change over time. But I think that the reality is that it certainly means a lot in Iran. It doesn't to some of the leaders. If you go back to the Green Movement, you had people who were, you know, very high up in the government saying, no, we need to do something, or supporting what Saudi Arabia is saying. So what we're really asking, when you ask that, is when Saudi Arabia, under the Crown Prince, under Mohammed bin Salman, says that we want moderate Islam, we don't want radical Islam, we don't want this is hugely radical for that region in the world, and we want the younger generation to have a shot at not to shoot people, but to have a shot at making money, economic. You see, the average Iranian, average Saudi only works 3 days a week, 3 days and 3 hours a day. And 52% of the entire work is done by foreigners. And they are graded by what country they come from. And all the way down to those who collect the trash and do all that. They do the bulk of the work. I mean, this can't go on. And Crown Prince has seen that, because you're not going to get $137 per barrel anytime in the near future. And by the way, that's one last thing we should keep in mind, that when Russia is negotiating with the United States or with others, they're also thinking about, what about our relationship with regards to oil? Because for America, yeah, that's his strength. So that's another thing they're going to argue about. Yes, please.
My question is about the nuclear agreement with Iran. And it's obvious that a lot of concern about that, and there's always a way to improve an agreement. But my question, is there an alternative to what we have?
Well, that's very much going to be debated, in Congress. Clearly, the agreement was written several years ago, and now it becomes more and more apparent that Iran is going nuclear. And that when we look at North Korea, that really reinforces that case. Because if North Korea, with a GNP per capita of $1,000, can go out and make a series of nuclear weapons, then Iran, which is not far down the track, but it's about $7,000 and has scientists and so forth, it would suggest that Iran can make that. And they are boasting about doing that, too. So I think the question isn't so much the agreement. The question is whether Iran can be persuaded to give up nuclear weapons, or looking at North Korea and several other countries out there, saying that's the only way that we can go. And the Saudis just said this. The Crown Prince just said this week. He said, the Iranians go nuclear, we're going nuclear. And after that, then Egypt will probably say it, and we could wind up with 10 or 20 states. And it may begin to sound like a prelude to an atomic version of World War I. We dearly hope not. But right now, it's kind of hard to know what's going to go on here, because the administration is still getting itself settled. Mike Pompeo is very clear that he wants change and he wants a new one. just as Rex Tillerson, who is now ousted, was very much for keeping the status quo. So we're not even sure where the administration stands until Pompeo's got to get approved. And we already had Rand Paul come out and say he's voting against him.
I'd be interested in what you have to say about the role of the United Nations in all of this.
I think that's one of the tragedies of the second half of the 20th century. And that is that the UN could have been a major influence. There's no question that coming off of World War II with 60 million dead, and with the Americans and others who take somewhat seriously these things, that there could have been a much better use of the United Nations. So instead, we're in a situation in which many countries, I can tell you, I was at the Indian embassy in Washington once, okay? And they have a beautiful embassy, big pictures of Gandhi and Nehru as you walk up the stairs. And it's very Indian. I've been there. It's very charming. So I ask the number two, who's the kind of the deputy ambassador, how come the Indians often vote against what we believe was their actual opinion, but it's largely line up with the great majority? And you know what he said? He said, who cares about the United Nations? And he'd been the deputy ambassador to the United Nations. Nobody gives a damn about it. So it's a free vote. That way we can get people to be together with us. He actually said that to me. I thought, wow, I didn't know. The trouble was, he's partly right. I mean, there has to be real consequences for people who violate things that the United Nations has done. And there really hasn't been. And it's the same thing from a Russian point of view. They've gone out and poisoned a number of their own people. There's been efforts at the UN to deal with that. And that ought to be illegal or whatever you want. There's got to be something, some reprisal for doing that. Frowned upon, at least, if not more. I mean, they're killing major politicians. Yeah, that Lushenko is another example. But they haven't. So I think when people look back at the 20th century, I think that was a great missed opportunity at a time when America was dominant in the 50s and 60s. And the Russians weren't even bothering to veto too much of that because they saw it as fairly worthless. And that's a tragedy because we like to think that something would come out of such a horrible war.
For many years, the Arab world was pushing the Palestinian issue very, very strongly. But we see, I think, that it's almost no one cares anymore about the Palestinians. And we hear even from Saudi Arabia.
Palestinians are saying that, too.
Excuse me?
Some Palestinians are saying that exactly.
Yeah, I'm just wondering that because now Iran poses a danger for Turkey and Israel and Saudi Arabia, whether even the Arabs are now giving up on Palestinian state? What's going to happen there?
You get that feeling. Palestinians are very unhappy with Saudi Arabia because the Saudis have made very clear now that they're going to align with the Israelis. And the Israelis talk a lot about that. And so assuming the Saudis do, and it's only for one reason. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's that simple. It doesn't. That's an old 2,400-year-old Indian saying, while we're on the Indians. And so from their point of view, the decision is already kind of taken. And that's a real problem here, that this is not what we thought in 1945. That, in fact, that's a very simple thing to think about, that after every major war, 1918, 1945, 1991, that we thought that it's all over. They called World War I the Great War, and it was all over, and World War II tripled the number of casualties. And yet, we keep going into the same thing. And now that nuclear weapons are much more obvious out there, the Arab states, let's say we had the Crown Prince here, and he was being honest. He would just say, I don't really like the Israelis. Probably is what he's thinking. I really don't like the Israelis. But you know what? I like even less the thought that the Iranians can come and launch nuclear weapons at our facility. Now, I'll give you one thing. One of my students, Jody Vittori, got her PhD with us, and she went to Saudi Arabia 6 times. This is before the reforms. And she said the thing that came to her mind so much, they visited military bases because she was in the American military. She was a lieutenant colonel. And she said the thing that struck the most about her was that the Saudis just aren't ready. They have 50, 60,000 men. They have 50,000 in the Home Guard. That's to prevent a domestic uprising. They've been spending huge amounts of money, $60, $80, $90 billion. But that doesn't take into account the teaching that you need, the working together that you need. It's going to take them at least another decade. And the other thing is, what are they fighting for? That may be what's pushing him, because these people are 18 to 25 years old, and he's trying to give them a future that's worth fighting for. But in the meantime, Saudi Arabia needs help militarily if they're going to withstand the Iranians. Because the Iranians don't have the world's great military, but they have one that's willing to fight and die. And as we saw in World War I, when some militaries, just like the French, put up their hands and say, okay, you know, in World War II, I'm sorry, 55 miles away, you know, we'll take care of it. We're going to give up. So that's something serious to think about for Iran, which also may push the Iranians prematurely to try to do something. Because down the road, the Saudis will get ready, and the United Arab Emirates is prepared to go with them. The Egyptians are going with them. The Jordanians are going with them. Because it's just, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Now, the Egyptians and the Jordanians already had relations with the Israelis. The Jordanians are so bad, it was finally revealed that once a month, whether we're talking in, what's the capital of Jordan? In Amman, or in Tel Aviv, or in Jerusalem, or along the border, that once a month the leaders of both sides sit down and talk to each other. And the reason is very simple. Jordan probably doesn't have any different view of this than Saudi Arabia. But what's the difference? They don't have the oil money, and they are an area that has a lot of danger. They have a very long border with Israel, and they're very afraid of what would happen. So for them, it was just a simple thing. That's what they had to do. That's what his father did, and that's where he was. You remember when they didn't do that back in 67, for example, they got destroyed in about 3 or 4 days, something like that. Saudis are also, they have another problem, massive refugee problem to deal with. They had over 1 million refugees come floating into their country, which already had been to Jordan. I mean, they need a lot of work. So the final one or two questions, yes.
Yes, I'm interested. Do you think, is the Geneva Initiative helping things in the Middle East, you know, between Israeli and the Palestinians, or is it hurting?
I would think a third way. I think it's not making any real difference right now. And the reason for it is that the Geneva Accord is kind of theoretical, but it doesn't, but for the Palestinians, they want the whole thing. And for the Israelis, they are worried about this, the votes at the UN and things like that. So they're eager to go into a different direction. And so I think that, the two sides could get together. There have been offers that have been made before for the great majority of the West Bank to go to the Palestinians, but that also even opens another door. Would this current regime be able to withstand Hamas, which was going to want the West Bank? And right now, who cares when the issue is nuclear weapons by North Korea or nuclear weapons for Iran? And therefore, this is another issue that kind of overarches this kind of issue. We should have a final question from you guys. Okay, so since we've done the impossible, run out of questions. Ah, yes. I knew we could flesh somebody out.
My sense is that in this country, if you said the word Middle East or mentioned certain countries, the the first thing that might come to a lot of people's mind would be terrorism, ISIS. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, is that a diminishing issue, or is that going to rear its head again, or where does radical Islamic terrorism?
All right, so let's take a vote. So how many think that radical Islam and in organizations like ISIS are still on the rise? And how many think they're in decline? Well, who am I to go against the majority? I think the reality is that more than a threat, because we've seen how the terrorists have been pushed back, by the Turkish, by Turks and by other forces. I think that they're not enough of a power to be able to take over many countries, but I think they're a good barometer for the level of disintegration of that society. Because when you get that, because we don't have that in the United States, we don't get it in Europe, and so forth. But when you get that kind of disintegration in society, that tells you really something, which is that not only was the Arab Spring a disaster, which, and what they wanted was good. And the only country that's paid any attention to them, anybody know, there's one country that is still influenced by the Arab Spring. Excellent. Who said that? There you go. No, that's great. It is Tunisia. There we see that the party that represented a more serious Islam actually yielded its place in the government and walked away. That was remarkable. But yet Tunisia has one dubious distinction. You know what that is? It's next to Libya. Tunisia has the largest number of fighters, over 7,000 in terrorist organizations. I don't know how the two go together. Obviously, these people need to talk to each other. Okay, and on that positive note, thank you very much. It was a pleasure coming to Montana.